This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Is climate change getting you down? Does it keep you up at night? Artists and academics are trying to express this new dis-ease. And mental health professionals are starting to see a new kind of climate trauma, too. Judith Deutsch is a psychoanalyst with a private practice in Toronto, Canada. Raised and educated in California, Judy has been on the faculty of the Toronto Psychoanalytic Institute. She is a wide-ranging voice for social conscience as past president of Science for Peace, a member of Independent Jewish Voices Canada, respected columnist for Canadian Dimension magazine, and contributor to Counterpunch. Judy Deutsch, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
There's only been very few hard data attempts to study this. A lot of what we know is just what people tell us or write about, but there was one called Empirical Evidence of Mental Health Risks Posed by Climate Change. It was published in October 2018 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And what they did, they got 2 million randomly sampled U.S. residents across a decade of data collection, they say, and they concluded that environmental stressors produced by climate change pose threats to human mental health. Well, you know, for me, Judy, that doesn't tell me much beyond the obvious. What are your feelings about that sort of scientific approach to this?
Well, I think it's very flawed. Questionnaires without having much information about people, you know, the individual people, really doesn't tell you very much. I know that there's quite a lot of, you know, around climate as well as in many other experiences and situations that in one way are catastrophic and disastrous. It doesn't really indicate whether, you know, in a psychological way people are traumatized or not. There's also a lot of complexity in terms of an event like an extreme weather event or these disasters and the kind of, you know, people's personal backgrounds as well as their what's available in their societies. I was thinking about this question. It's something that I've felt very dubious about for quite a long time. And I was thinking about examples from the psychoanalytic experiences, you know, with what appear to be traumatic situations. I was thinking about two that are quite relevant. One is quite early on, was during World War II, during the London Blitz. Anna Freud and several other child analysts set up war nurseries for children who had to leave London because of the tremendous danger of being bombed and so on. And what they did was they tried to maintain family groups and to encourage parents, particularly mothers, to visit these war nurseries, which were located outside of London, as frequently as possible. And that contrasts, for instance, very, very dramatically with the residential school system, which was the opposite. You know, it was taking children away from their society, their families. So you have to look at what are the mediators, the social and institutional ways that traumatic disasters can be dealt with. So you have to look at the, you know, what the society provides. And, you know, in the United States now, the public infrastructure providing help has really so profoundly declined. That's possibly one reason that people are feeling quite helpless. But there are other instances, like during Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Sandy, you know, when communities came together and helped each other. So, you know, there's many different ways that disasters can be dealt with.
It's true. You know, I'm thinking of Katrina now. Some of the people there lost their homes, but more than their homes, they lost their community and their whole sense of roots, and they dispersed throughout the United States. They went to Houston and they went to Denver and so on. But others, as you say, sort of gathered together and said, well, let's reimagine New Orleans. We're going to rebuild this place. And for them, it may have been more positive. I'd like to move on to something that an American professor, E. Ann Kaplan, she wrote a book in 2016 called Climate Trauma. And she was just looking at global warming in movies and literature. And she talked about pre-traumatic stress syndrome. And this sort of clashed with the very little knowledge I have about Freud and the early roots of psychoanalysis, because it seemed to me in those roots, Freud was talking about events that had happened in the past and didn't really envision the possibility of future trauma. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a very good question, because I think that he certainly wrote a lot and did respond to World War One. He actually lost a daughter in the ensuing flu epidemic. So he did write a lot about war and the war and so on. So he was certainly, you know, aware of current trauma. But what he did point out was that people's reactions are very so much influenced by their early experiences, and how their earlier experiences can be reinterpreted at different developmental stages of life, as well as in the context of what they encounter in their society. You know, all these things have a very important bearing on how people experience disaster. And centrally in Freud, too, is how realistic they can be. Do their memories and their fears and their wishes impede their ability to understand what the reality is?
We know some people are prone to depression for whatever reasons, and I'm wondering, do you think that people who are struggling with mental health issues should avoid finding out more about climate change until they feel better?
Again, I think it depends on how it's dealt with, you know, and again, of course, one can ask them whether they feel ready to hear about things that are difficult. And also, it's so important to be able to disconfirm what might be a belief that's distorted, you know, by their proclivity to depression and hopelessness. From an analytic point of experience, you know, it could be very helpful to talk with people and to sort out, again, with them, hearing what their worries are when they're ready to talk about them, you know, what is realistic and not. And also what they can do or what they would need, you know, not to feel so hopeless and helpless, too.
Would you talk to us about your article, Convenient Untruths About Human Nature? How does that apply here?
Okay, well, one reason I wrote that is because when I was president of Science for Peace, and also I've been involved in these kind of bad and other issues for a while and have participated in many, many different kinds of organizations and groups and stuff. And what I heard so often was that there were assumptions about people that were really incorrect, basically. A lot of truisms, in a way, you know, about human nature. And so often people, you know, spokespeople, very, very sharp people would generalize a lot about we, you know, we do this, and, you know, humans do this, and so on and so forth. And the effect of that was really to prevent really thinking about what the problem was in the first place. In a way, I felt it was really diminishing of people to assume that you can choose what to tell people or not. You know, again, if something is difficult to hear, then you could listen to that and help people with it. But some of these truisms are so common now, you know, like talking about as if consumerism is a basic instinct, as if people can't have a realistic sense of time. They can't see too much in the future. They're living in the present. Or that you can't ask people to give up anything. I think in an even much more insidious and concerning way is the prediction that people will be violent, you know, in the face of particular hardships, like if they're deprived of water and food, you're going to see, or if they need to migrate, they'll storm borders, or they'll fight each other for the last scrap of food and water and that kind of thing. And historically, that's utterly inaccurate. And psychologically, it's also utterly inaccurate, too. So, you know, to describe people as if wars are inevitable, the violence and so on. And again, you know, there's so much historically that shows that there's innumerable ways that people have dealt with these things with each other. I guess, you know, you're thinking about the Nobel Prize to Eleanor Ostrom, you know, who disputed the idea that the commons were disastrous in themselves, the tragedy of the commons, that people will just use up the resources until everything is gone, you know, and that's not what happens. People, over and over again, organize themselves Yeah, like, you know, like what happened in Katrina and Sandy. I was talking about the immediate reaction to those events, you know, when people really helped each other.
They did. They brought boats from all over the country to go and try and rescue people, and they brought food and barbecues to get some meat going for those who eat it. Yeah. This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Judy Deutsch about climate and mental health. Another thing I've been wondering about is whether there's any rational explanation for why so many climate scientists and other experts still say we have 12 years left to save a good climate, or we can still get 1.5 parts per million CO2 rise, when from everything that I'm reading and the scientists that talk to us, that's no longer possible. So I wonder, are authorities trying to sell us false optimism, or are we demanding that optimism as part of every message that we get? I don't know.
Well, you know, that's also just such a crucial thing to try to figure out, and such an important question and observation. Because I fully agree with you, you know, that this idea of the 12 years and 1.5 degrees, I mean, it's going to be exceeded certainly within a decade, you know, because of amplifying feedback, increasing rate of emissions and so on. But I don't think there's a scientist. I hear this in so many environmental groups and, you know, even the very sharp people, you know, like Naomi Klein and unfortunately, and you know, the people in the Green New Deal and so on. I think that there's a lot of some fundamental things about the climate systems that just are not explained very clearly to people. I think there's a problem with education, too, you know, the responsibility of universities. But one thing that I from a psychological angle that I think is at work is what happens in groups, you know, that there is, I think, an unwillingness for various reasons, I'm sure, to challenge people who are in positions of authority, to question them. It's interesting because James Hansen in his book on Terms of My Grandchildren gave an example of that with when he was a young scientist, Richard Feynman, being the only one who could challenge Niels Bohr because, you know, he was young. He didn't have any big reputation to lose in a way. And Hansen has written about the reticence of scientists. But I think there's a huge problem, and I've observed it so many times with people not challenging people who are in authority, as if there's a culture, you know, of compliance.
Well, we probably need that to some degree for society to function at all. I mean, if everybody's an anarchist, it's very hard to put a society together. And it's ingrained to us in childhood. I mean, you do what your parents tell you.
Well, it can be. I mean, there's been a lot of work on authoritarian versus non-authoritarian families and so on. But it's not anarchism that I'm talking about. It has to do with being informed and being able to question and to challenge on the basis of being informed, you know, of being able to discuss. It's interesting because being able to discuss and argue is also, if I could mention a couple of philosophers, you know, seen as being the most necessary and essential character of democracy. You know, I mean, Thucydides brought that up, and, you know, and his work on the Peloponnesian War, and then, you know, very very recently, Amartya Sen says that discussion and arguing, being informed and so on, is the critical aspect of what makes a democracy, really.
I just missed the second name that you mentioned, the more recent philosopher. Who was that?
It's Amartya Sen, S-E-N, and he wrote a book called The Idea of Justice, which is very, very interesting. What he writes a lot about, it's about people being able to figure out with each other and talk with each other, even, you know, young children, in a much more complex way about how to solve problems, you know.
Now, along the ideas of justice, as far as I know, the UN Convention on Refugees and the subsequent international law still does not recognize climate refugees, and we know Donald Trump sure doesn't. So we know rising seas and extreme climate-driven events will set off the greatest mass migrations probably in human history. Do you think governments are waking up? Are we ready at all? Are we psychologically ready for what's coming in that regard?
Well, again, this is so crucial and horrible what the situation is. Right now there's, 68 million displaced people, partly due to war, extreme poverty, weather events, and so on. And you're exactly right. The UN does not protect climate refugees, and that's terrible. I think that the rightward swing of governments is going so much in the wrong direction, you know, in a very narrow nationalist, protectionist. I mean, at the end of the Cold War, I think there were 15 walled borders, and now there's 77. And the borders are militarized with, as we know, these awful detention centers. It seems to me that this, again, requires questioning and a dealing right now with the whole idea of borders. There's some excellent work on just taking down borders. Personally, I think that that's critical. I mean, you can't have billions of people, you know, without any access to migration, because there's going to be large parts of the world that are uninhabitable. You know, there's sea level rise, there's extreme temperatures. I think on one of your recent programs, maybe, people were talking about that at high temperatures, the wet bulb temperature is unlivable. You know, at 35 degrees wet bulb temperature, you know, people cannot survive, even in the shade, for more than 6 minutes, it's said. So.
Well, and I think there's a growing public fear that mass deaths are in our future, even in this century, possibly. And we try to think that, well, people over there will be the ones to die, not our relatively rich selves. There's the concept of disposable people, and there's the problem of if we actually accept that a climate-driven Holocaust is coming, what does that do to us from the psychoanalytic perspective?
So again, this is, I think, related from a psychoanalytic view. It has to do with, I think, what I would call a pathogenic belief. You know, the pathogenic belief being that other people will take what we have, will threaten our lives, and so on and so forth. And it doesn't need to be that way at all, you know. And that means, for one, that we have to do everything we can right now to eliminate the threats to life, like eliminate fossil fuel emissions entirely and dismantle the military. I mean, that's what we can get into that. But, you know, how does one prepare for taking care of everybody? It's, you know, there's Naomi Klein and others talk about system change. Well, it has to be spelled out what that is going to look like so that everyone is able to survive. I know you had Mike Davis on the program recently, and he's a really brilliant historian who wrote this book about the late Victorian Holocaust, in which up to 50 million people died. But, you know, we can get into that a little bit more. But one of the very fascinating things in the book was that he described a period in the 18th century in China where people were taken care of, you know, in these situations where there was the threat of mass death, that they had prepared for it. They provided the necessities of life. There's other examples that people talk about now, like what happened to Cuba in the 1990s when they lost their entire economy, their fossil fuel-based economy, and had to radically transform their agricultural system so that they could eat, so they could feed their people, you know. And this was done without the disasters that happened in the Soviet Union and in China and in India around their very much failed agricultural transformations, in which, you know, tens of millions of people died and so on. This is all avoidable, you know. If people work together and use the best of their knowledge in figuring out, you know, all these things are avoidable.
You know, I'm thinking about, okay, how are we going to handle this? I feel there's a stress on myself covering this, and I get emails from listeners saying that they feel stressed about it, but there's not going to be enough trained mental health professionals to deal with a tsunami of upset people if the future is very disrupted. I talked with UK psychotherapist Rosemary, or Ro Randall, about her healing movement called Carbon Conversations. There's circles of people who meet to share their feelings about climate change, Do you think we can help ourselves, Judy, with local climate conversation or support groups?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very important thing there because, you know, a lot of people can be helpful. It's not just trained psychotherapists. In fact, often, you know, trained people also do quite a lot of harm in all these professions. But certainly, yeah, people can be very helpful to each other. Even in medicine, I recently met and read the book by Gretchen Rohde. I think that's how you pronounce her name, but she's a physician who has worked for decades, you know, partly with Medecins Sans Frontières, but other groups too, in horrible conditions around the world. And you know what paraprofessional people are now able to do? Like, you don't have to be a doctor now to do brain surgery, you know? I mean, there's incredible things that people can learn how to do. They're doing it. I mean, it's already been the news. And, you know, you have this whole tradition, too, of course, like with nurse midwives, you know, being in charge of dealing with pregnancy and childbirth and so on. So you don't have to be trained professionals for many, many years and so on to be helpful.
I remember back in college, sort of psychology 101, reading about a double bind theory, and I think that may apply to the situation we're in now because we know we're damaging the climate every day by driving cars, by the way our food system works, everything. And yet we have to keep on doing it because we depend on that for our survival, we think. That sounds pretty familiar, too, to people with other damaging personal behaviors that they can't control. Should we be talking about carbon addiction, for example?
For some reason, this, and I do think it has to do with the irresponsibility of people who are in positions of influence. And I hear, you know, include, you know, people in city councils and universities and so on and so forth. They've reneged on their responsibility. I go to the gym at the University of Toronto, and I see everyone, you know, pushing buttons to instead of walking through a turnstile, you know, to get into the gym. And it's not like that's going to emit very much, but it's as if nothing is on their mind, you know, about using excess electrical energy, you know, or for a brief time, plastic bags cost a few cents. So nobody used plastic bags. And then somehow that got overturned into everybody's using plastic bags. It's very bizarre, but I feel concerned that when the solutions that are proffered are so out of sync with the magnitude of the problem that it creates a lot of doubt and skepticism in people about how serious the problem really is. And that's been the case all along, you know, that the proffered solutions have been so disproportionate to what the problem is. Certainly there are efforts to address aspects of it, like there's a free public transit movement here in Toronto, but there has to be so much more of that. It's so easy to sidetrack what the full picture is. You know, and in terms of ignorance, in 2000, I think it was 2009, it was before the Copenhagen meetings, and it was when I was president of Science for Peace, we were fortunate enough to have James Hansen come and talk. We did it in collaboration with the Center for Global Change Science, and we brought together for the first time James Hansen, Naomi Klein, and Clayton Thomas Mueller from the Indigenous Environmental Network. He's a tar sands campaigner. So we were what I was wanting to do was to bring together these intersecting aspects having to do with climate change and climate justice, and you know the system, the capitalist system too. So James Hansen had just written his book, and it was just published, The Storms of My Grandchildren, which, to my mind, is a fascinating book, and I think it's an essential book. He's such a brilliant scientist, and I think demonstrates what scientific thinking, like his way of questioning and observing things in the physical world. I don't think he's very good in terms of politics, but his scientific work is so important. Anyway, the University of Toronto has, I think, one of the largest university libraries in North America. So I noticed it took quite a long time for them to even get one copy of his book. Now, after 10 years, there's only two copies of his book in the entire University of Toronto system, whereas there's multiple copies of other people, like, who are essentially climate skeptics, or they befuddle the whole thing, like Bjorn Lomborg. So, you know, he'll have 10 to 20 copies in the library, whereas in France, there's only two. So I taught a class there for a couple of years on climate justice, and the students told me, you know, that it was hardly ever talked about. This is a subject that should be, that all departments should be working on it, and working together. It's hard to understand. In the class that I taught, the students talked about it, and they said that, it's more of like a cultural, and there's an aspect of cultural style. They said that in their social groups, you're not supposed to talk about anything that's stressful, you know. But however, if you do something, you know, like if you, then you'll be imitated and copied, but you're not supposed to talk about it. Like they implemented recycling and composting and all that kind of stuff. And then everybody did it, but they weren't willing to talk about it. So this is a particular culture amongst these students and an educated and affluent aspect, a little group, but it's hard to know. A couple of years ago, I was in Guatemala, too, as part of a health delegation to look at the impact of mining on the people. And there were people from Guatemala, Panama, southern part of Mexico. And they were completely straightforward and forthcoming about what was going on and its psychological social impact, you know, young people too. And they were talking about climate change. So, you know, again, it's hard to make generalizations about why and how these things happen. But from an analytic point of view, psychoanalytic, you know, really, I think quite central in Freud was addressing the capacity to deal with reality, to perceive reality, to act in accordance with reality. And there's the inside reality, the psychological world, and then there's the outside. And what he helped people with is to disentangle, again, their fears and their wishes from what the realities are. And what you do is you help people. You know, if it feels like it's too overwhelming, then you can talk with them about what aspect is overwhelming and what can be done. Maybe it is too overwhelming and there's nothing, but often there is. In any groups, there are people who are able to think through and try to figure out what to do. You know, like you're talking about buying and cars and all that kind of stuff. So then, like, these are things that have to change. So you say, how can we do that? What's the best way that we can do that? What are the different possibilities rather than avoiding the whole thing altogether?
And as we wrap up here, Judy, do you have people or places beyond what you've already mentioned? You mentioned some great stuff to recommend for our listeners who want to learn more.
I would recommend three people in particular. I had mentioned, the Mike Davis book, Late Victorian Holocaust, is very important. But also Andreas Malm, M-A-L-M, is excellent. And Jason Moore. And there's two French people who've written a book together that's really superb. It's called The Shock of the Anthropocene by Benoît and Verso. It's published by Verso, and these are just excellent, very, very carefully researched histories that disprove for many of the assumptions that I think have been paralyzing in terms of trying to figure out what to do.
The Shock of the Anthropocene, and this is Radio EcoShock, as it turns out, and I'm going to put links to pretty well everything we've talked about and some more helpful links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. I want to mention things like climatepsychologyalliance.org, which has got a whole bunch of things going on. There's speakers coming up in London with Jem Bendel and Ro Randall in April 2019. That sort of thing you can find out. I'll put it in my blog. Check that out for sure. From Toronto, Canada, we've been talking with practicing psychoanalyst, journalist, and activist Judy Deutsch. Judy, thank you.
Thank you.
We ran out of time on that one, but you can listen to or download my full 49-minute interview with Judy Deutsch from my website at ecoshock.org. Next week, we're back to more shocking climate science from some of the best in the world. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.